if I might have your attention for just a few moments. First, can those of you in the back of the room hear our voices of the PA system working? It is. Thank you very much. The fire marshal has asked that I point out to you that the exits to this room are to the north wall, and I don't think we're going to have to use them for any special purpose. You know, looking at this audience, what a fantastic thing. We've been talking with our children, as perhaps you have, the last 3 or 4 weeks about that movie E.T. and all the lines for E.T., and all I can say is, E.T., eat your heart out. It thrills me beyond belief to be in my hometown of Billings, Montana, where in McKinley High School I read history books about presidents, about men who made history, and to be here with you great people today with our president. I'd like you to know that we are here, however, because you're here, because of a movement that began in America a few years ago that said we need less government, we need an honest government. And that's why we're up here, because you made that possible. And I want to tell you what you made possible today. You made possible the largest single political fundraising event in the history of the great state of Montana. And I'm going to applaud that. You are wonderful people. This is going to make possible the election for the second time in the history of this state, a Republican senator. And to that I can only echo, John Melcher, eat your heart out. It's been a real event for us these past few days. With about a 4-day notice, and there's some people that I would like to stand as I call your names, and I hope all of you will join with me in applauding these people. They're the ones who made it possible, and the logistics of this event are phenomenal. But if these people would stand, please, Earl Rozelle, Tilly Pierce, oh, Tilly, has she been fantastic. Tom Keating, my great friend, Tom Keating. Tom, stand up, please. Randy Rager, almost sounds like Ronald Reagan. Mae Jenkins, Lucille and Norman Mills, Bill Seams, Gene McClain, Tom and Sarah Hurst, if you would please, Jess O'Hara, Tom Hanna, and Marge Seams. You've done a great job. Thank you very much. I added the best speech of my life to give to you people today. But I gave that speech last night from 2 in the morning to 7 in the morning 55 times, and I'm tired of hearing it. But in that speech, what I wanted to talk about was that if for just the brief moment we stepped aside of being political figures and instead took a historical view of the last 2 years, we would look back and we would see that 2 years ago, people had literally written off the economic future and the future of the people of the United States of America. And what has transpired in that interim 2 years is history changing as well as history making. People were saying it was all over, that we had to quit. Kind of reminds me of the story of, I sit on the board of directors of a little publishing company, and we had on that board, we were trying to get a new board member. Someone was reviewing the application, and the chairman of the board said, "We can't take this person. He is a confirmed total alcoholic, has been all his life." And another fellow said, "Well, at least you can't call the guy a quitter." And there were a few people who didn't quit on America, who in fact said there's vision, there's future for this great opportunity, for this country. And so in the last 2 years, as historians, you would note that interest rates have declined by 30% from 21 to 15%. That 2.5 years ago, the weakest currency in the world was the United States dollar, and now it's the strongest. And you would continue saying that in the state of Montana, unemployment has declined a full percentage point in the last reporting period. That the problems we had of society, which were magnitude at that time have lessened, that we are better off now than we were when Jimmy Carter was in office. Certainly, a social historian would have written 2.5 years ago that every place that that social historian went, the topic of conversation was what? Inflation. When's the last time you heard someone talk seriously about inflation? It's gone from 18% or wherever it was to we don't even talk about it. Because an individual stood up and said, we need a new beginning. All presidents make history. Few presidents change history. Ronald Reagan has changed history. And I give you our president.
I thank you for those kind and generous words. And old friends here at the head table and distinguished guests who are here, and you ladies and gentlemen, and just to think that Larry's opponent's probably holding a fundraiser someplace in another state. It's a real pleasure to be with you in the nation's treasure state. Every day at the White House, I pass a painting that's hanging in the hall near my office. It's a spectacular view of Montana, captured by your native son, Charles Russell. And one could argue whether your treasure is in your shining mountains, your forests, your farms, cattle ranges, or in the metal under the ground. I know you have these riches and more, but in the state of Montana, you nurture an American treasure that's even more priceless, the frontier spirit of your people. An Englishman in the 19th century described the pioneers of the American West by saying, motion was in their days. City dwellers, cowpunchers, miners, mountain men across this vast state share a strength that was born of self-reliance, the kind of can-do attitude that tamed this continent. This harvest season, as your fields of green wheat ripen, America needs to reap more than your abundant grain, to export your spirit to help with the renewal of America. Send Larry Williams to Washington to work with us as a United States Senator. Congressman that's here, Marlon A., they're already, so we have an expectation of what another Montanan can do to help in Washington. Republicans have been a majority in the Senate now for a year and a half. An important reason why we have been able to achieve such historic reversals of the big spending, big taxing policies that got us into this recession. With their help, we not only slowed the growth of government, we cut it nearly in half. The annual rate of spending increasing far greater than the annual rate of increase in revenues from our taxing system. We passed a tax bill that reduced the tax burden on American citizens by about, well, it'll be $406 billion of savings to you over the 3 years, 83 through 85. We put in place an economic program that was already has reduced inflation, as Larry told you, by half, more than half, and interest rates have come down also, and as he said, by more than a quarter. We have much more to do if we're to sustain the recovery that has just begun. We can't afford to yield to the budget-busting currents of the past. And those Republican senators are an important bulwark against the riptide of big government that had been dragging us under. Because of the importance of building our margin in the Senate and Larry's commitment to our program, it's a special pleasure for me to speak on his behalf. As I've said before, no matter how tough my job gets, sometimes I wake up at night in a cold sweat thinking how much worse it could be if we didn't have a Republican majority in the Senate. As I said to a little group just a short time ago, imagine having two Tip O'Neills. But with your help, we're going to make it an even bigger margin this November. Some of you may not know that in 1980, 9 Senate seats were decided by less than 2% of the vote, and Republicans won 7 of those. And these few extra senators have made all the difference. We're this very week engaged in a battle to restore fiscal responsibility to the federal government. Now, the battle is being waged over a tax bill passed by the Senate and being considered by the House. But the larger issue is whether or not the federal government can be made to live within its means. Past Congresses and past administrations racked up huge deficits during the last 20 years. As year after year, the budget went unbalanced 19 times in those 20 years, and our national debt grew larger. Today, interest payments alone on that debt are more than the entire budget was in 1962, just 20 years ago. As a matter of fact, those who can remember back will remember for a while there, when it was getting close to $100 billion, how Lyndon Johnson worked to try and not be the first one to hit $100 billion. And today, that's the interest we pay on the debt that they were piling up. The federal government has usurped more and more of our natural and national resources, driving interest rates skyward, our people out of work and our country into recession. Now, I don't think the people of Montana will accept much more of that, and you shouldn't. And I'm determined to set this government on a course of fiscal sanity, eventually balancing the budget, but not on the back of the American taxpayer. Now, I know that lately you've heard something different. You've heard that we're now backing the biggest single tax increase in our nation's history. And supposedly, I have turned around and have given up on the original philosophy of cutting spending and so forth and going in a different direction. Well, the tax bill that is now before the House will not raise income taxes on the average American. 3/4 of the bill won't even have much of an effect on that middle income taxpayer who faithfully and honestly fills out his forms every year. The bill is actually designed to better collect taxes that are owed but are not now being paid, to close unintended tax advantages for the few and cut off unintended benefits. And this bill will help ensure that all businesses, no matter what their size, and all Americans, no matter how great their wealth, pay their fair share of taxes along with everyone else. But if I may, I welcome this opportunity to try and explain, because it hasn't been properly explained and it hasn't been reported this way. Last year, we were successful in getting our tax cut program phased in over a 3-year period. The next phase is coming in July of 1983, another 10% cut in the income tax, some other things, and then indexing. And as you know what that means, that for all these years of inflation, every time a worker got a cost of living pay raise that didn't make him any better off, just had to try to keep up with the cost of living, It, however, pushed him into a higher bracket of the income tax, and by the time he paid that, he was worse off than he'd been the year before. So the standard of living in this country has been going down steadily. When we finish getting that last installment of the income tax, then the last thing that is done is we index the brackets so they are indexed to inflation if there's any left by then, and you won't move up into another bracket just from getting a cost of living increase. Now, what we started this year, as we promised we would last, that there were more cuts to go in government spending, more reductions that had to be made in that rate of increase. Until we get that rate of increase down to at least level or less than the rate of normal increase in government's revenues. And this time, however, we found we could not put together the coalition because we only control one house, not two, the coalition to get what we got last year unless we would agree to some increased revenues. And what revenues do you think our opponents wanted us to increase? They didn't really call for an increase. They said, cancel the rest of those tax cuts that are yet to go into effect. And I dug in my heels and said, not by a sight. So, but it became evident that we could not get the spending cuts that were needed without. So we had known and had spoken the year before of some areas that we knew where taxes were not being paid that were owed under the present tax laws. And we started volunteering a program of better administration of the tax program, better collection of those revenues. It wasn't enough of a compromise. So the compromise has led to what is the $99 billion package over 3 years. And this is what they're calling the biggest tax increase in history. The tax increase they passed a couple of years ago before we got here in Social Security payroll tax will take $112 billion more in those same 3 years, which is a little bigger than 99. But the 99 is not entirely a tax increase. $31 billion of it is the collection of money presently owed and not being paid. $17 billion of it represents some tax increases. And the other roughly 50% of the $99 billion represents correcting some legislation from the past that has led to unintended tax benefits. A piece of legislation, for example, that was passed several years ago and that one particular industry in this country found an obscure paragraph and it was interpreted by the courts in such a way that they were able to get a 60% tax cut for themselves. That had not been intended in the legislation. So the actual tax increase is 17%. The containment of these others that is escaping is 31%, and the rest of it is, as I say, a tax reform closing some of these things that we think we're giving advantages to some that weren't available to all. But that is the price we have had to pay for getting the reductions in spending. And what it amounts to over the next 3 years is we will reduce, if this bill is passed, we will reduce the deficits by $380 billion. And $280 of that will be in reduction in spending outlays, and 99, call it 100, will be this present tax program. I figure that yes, it's a compromise, but we're getting $3 reduction in outlays for $1 in the increased revenues, and you're still getting that $406 billion in tax cuts that we passed last year, and I figure the compromise is worth it because the most important thing is We must curtail those deficits, eliminate those deficits as soon as we can, and get the interest rates down so that prosperity will come back to this country. Montana, it's easy to understand why Thomas Jefferson believed that America had room enough for our descendants to the thousandth and thousandth generation. And our task today is to reaffirm the principles that shaped on this land a way of life that is unique in history. We've, for too many years, been told that the only logical place to turn for help of any kind is to Washington. And you know, sometimes, and I know that the people that have said this are well-intentioned. I know that many of the programs that have been proposed over the past had the best of intention and set out and only wanted to help people. But when you set out to help people, you'd better be sure of what you're doing. And they weren't all that sure. They make me think of the old story, and maybe some of you know it, of the fellow riding a motorcycle on a cold winter day, and the wind was coming through the buttons on holes on his leather jacket and chilling him till he stopped, got off the motorcycle, turned the jacket out around, and put it on backward. Well, now he's all right from the cold, but his arm movement's kind of restricted. He hit a patch of ice, skidded into a tree. And when the police got there and elbowed their way through the crowd that had gathered, and they said, "What happened?" They said, "We don't know. When we got here, he seemed to be all right, but by the time we had his head turned around straight, he was dead." I've talked and stressed this tax thing, but I want you to know that we haven't neglected a lot of other things. We're asking for some constitutional amendments, and I'm very amused when I stop to think that 40 states or more have in their state constitutions that the budget must be balanced. Federal government's never had that, so it's got a $1 trillion debt. And we have asked for a budget balancing amendment to the United States Constitution that the federal budget has to be balanced. And some people are calling it a hoax and saying that it'll never work. Why should the federal government think it can do what all the rest of us don't have to do in our private lives and what we don't have to do at local government and every place else? They'd better start spending within their means, and we're going to keep whittling at them until that's the way it turns out. That you've hinted that that's what you'd like, why, let me just say, you just be sure that you run Larry Williams out of Montana. Just send him to Washington, D.C. He'll come back often, I know, to check on things here. But we need him there. We need him in that Senate. We need his help, just as we need your Congressman Marlon A. there on the other side, and we hope in November that we'll add some more allies to his house over there so that we can move faster in what it is we're trying to do. But you know that you've got a good man here. You know where he stands and what he stands for. And I'll know when he gets there that he was sent there by Montanans. I have to leave. Goodbye, and God bless you. And thank you.